Hello, and welcome to the Voices for Change radio show on the Incandescent Radio Network. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, producer of Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. Thrilled to be here with Tracy Schott and her guest for today. Tracy is the creator of VoicesForChange.net, an amazing organization determined to stomp out domestic abuse, intimate partner violence. And we are here today with Lisette Johnson. I'm going to read to you a little bit about Lisette's story. In October 2009, she was shot several times by her husband at close range with her then 12-year-old daughter as a witness. He turned the gun on himself and took his own life. And Lisette, we are just so sorry for your experience, your loss, but we're thrilled to have you here today. ShamelessSurvivors.com is your organization. And wow, so I'm gonna turn it over to our host, Tracy Schott, and we're gonna have a wonderful conversation.
Hi, everybody. So I met Lisette in 2014, and we were filming. It was our final year of filming Finding Jen's Voice, and I had done a outreach on social media looking for survivors of intimate partner homicide attempts to interview, and Lisette was one of the first people to reach out to me. When I heard her story, I was, of course, blown away by the trauma that she had experienced just 5 years earlier. And I was also blown away by how articulate and informed she was. Lisette is part of a group of survivors in Finding Jen's Voice. I set up a private Facebook group for them all called the Finding Jen's Voice Heroes right at the time that I met them all. And Lisette is the sage of the group. Whenever anybody has a question about research or data or wants to know something, they're like, hey, who knows, Lisette, about this issue? And she knows. So not only does she bring her survivor experience to us today, she also brings a great deal of knowledge because she's one smart cookie. She's also, over the last few years since the film was released, participated in some conference work with me, and she's become my friend. And so I'm really happy to have you here, Lisette. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tracy. Yes, I did. I was one of those people that when something happened to me, I was just obsessive about finding out everything I could possibly find out about how this happened, about trauma, about how to help my kids. I was just became this vessel for, you know, for knowledge, because I really didn't understand any of the dynamics. I didn't understand what had happened to us.
And I think it, in many ways that's our connection, because I'm kind of the same way when I'm doing a film about something. Like, I want to know everything. Like, I want to be an expert in what I'm talking about. And that happened to the nth degree with this film. But, you know, and I immerse myself in the research and all of the theoretical knowledge that was out there. But I learned the most from you and your survivor sisters that are in the film. And it was really that experience for me that made me want to create Voices for Change, because I felt like survivor voices in this space are too often overlooked, ignored, and of all of the people I spoke with in creating Finding Jen's Voice, and it was upwards to like 40 different people that I, probably more than that, 60 people that I talked with over the course of 4 years. It was the survivor experiences that really were the most informative. So I'm really happy to be able to include your voice in this show, and again, always grateful to Hope for facilitating this experience for us all. So let's get started. Hope mentioned, and maybe we just want to start with the experience that you had with being shot at close range, and you almost died. You want to give us a little bit of background about what happened that day?
You look at me and you go, well, you know, she must be fine. And you know, as I've shared before, I almost did die. I was shot. He stood about 4 feet from me. He was aiming at my head, and I sort of instantly, you know, understood and stood up and started running, and he kept shooting me. And the last shot he shot me was in the back. So I was actually shot 4 times. And then of course there was a final shot, and I had seen my daughter out of the corner of my eye, and I couldn't turn around because I knew I'd be full frontal. And so I kept running, but I did not know who he had shot. And, you know, as it turned out, I later found out days later that he had actually shot himself. But as you can imagine, it was a split second where it all happened very quickly. I mean, he had come into the house. You know, I had said, I want to leave the relationship. I want to leave the marriage. And I had been working on, you know, getting an attorney and looking for places to live and kind of navigating the children. And at that time, you know, I had just come home from church, and he had stayed home with the children, and he kept saying he was going to leave the house, but he never left. You know, he said, I'm not going to, abandon my marital property. You need to leave. And so we were sort of negotiating and navigating through what should be a separation. They're never fun, but they're certainly not supposed to be dangerous. And when I sent this message, it was just basically, there's nothing you can do to we are done. This is over. I'm done. And you know, he walked into the room and he said, I want to know how you're going to live. And I said, I have no idea. I just have faith that it will all work out. And then he came back in, and I was sitting in the chair in the corner. He came back in with a gun, and I immediately recognized everything that had happened the months and weeks before. Just kind of like, you know, a light bulb literally went off in my head, and I stood up.
So you were married for 21 years. What changed? What made you decide to leave the relationship?
You know, looking back, when you're navigating through something, you don't always see. It's like the dot here, a dot there, a dot there. And of course, when you look back, you can connect them all. And it was a series of just very small, almost imperceptible little abuses. And sometimes they weren't so little, you know, and I compartmentalized them, you know, went about my life. You know, I had a pretty full life, you know, I had girlfriends. He tried to isolate me, but he was not very successful. So I had girlfriends, and my family was very involved with my family, my kids, activities. But it got to a point where I couldn't keep compartmentalizing because it overflowed and the walls started to crumble. And it was like a dam that you see is getting ready. And so you're going to patch it here and patch it there and patch it there. And I just ran out of patches. I just couldn't keep it all together. And there was a precipitating event. I actually had like a really bad bronchitis that year over the holidays, and went to my doctor was changing. They were moving their office. So I just went to an urgent care. They did a typical X-ray for, you know, make sure I didn't have pneumonia. And then he came in very serious looking. And he said, you know, we've got something pretty serious on your X-ray. And I'm like, well, what? And he said, you've got a lung tumor. And I was just like, what? And he said, you know, you need to go get a CT scan as soon as possible. But because it was over the holidays, everything was closed. So I had to wait 10 days, and I had 10 days of real soul searching. Is this the legacy I'm leaving for my children? And is this the man I'm leaving my children with? And, what I've been doing, what have I been doing the last 20 years? Like, this is my life. So it was literally a wake up call, fortunately. It was, something, I don't know what was wrong with the equipment or misread or whatever, but I did get the CT scan, nothing, commendable about it. And, but they had put me on some steroids, and, steroids can really mess with your body. And they put me on a lot of them. And so I went into sort of a, you know, combination, you know, steroid induced mania, you know, depression, and decided that I needed to, you know, take a little time out from all this. And I went into a psychiatric unit for 7 days, and I got in there and I was like, oh. I literally called it the spa.
The spa.
I called it the spa. I was like, oh my God. You know, and the weight of the world was lifted off me. And, you know,
tells you something about the amount of stress you were under when going into a psychiatric ward was a break.
It was a break. I was so happy. And, you know, of course, there was a lot going on. I didn't even leave with any kind of medication or anything. Afterwards, they connected me with a psychiatrist who did actually, because at that point, then the steroids were wearing off. And as anybody who's had steroids, the depression is quite notable. So then they were trying to mitigate that depression with some medication. And, but I, you know, and of course, then I sought therapy too, because I had this awareness that this isn't going to go away. And I actually, when I got out, thought, okay, maybe things will be okay. And literally that, you know, and they had said when I exited, or, you know, discharged, you know, make sure she's calm and, you know, no stress. And of course that night it was like, I want to know how you're going to pay this hospital bill. Like, you better come up with some money for this, because it wasn't a partnership. And that night I realized this is not my partner. This is somebody who sees that, you know, I'm just this being here for him. I'm the servant, you know, I'm the, you know, the person who takes care of his children. I contribute to the household. So, you know, I better be able to pay my own bills.
The transactional relationship.
Transactional relationship. Exactly. Exactly. And so I started therapy.
And was it helpful?
Well, you know, it's only as helpful as honest as you want to be with yourself. And I wasn't still quite ready to be honest. So it's kind of garbage in, garbage out. I shared all the wonderful parts of our relationship. What a great guy he was. He watched the kids while I was in the hospital. Well, of course he did. That's what fathers are supposed to do, but he didn't normally do that. So it seemed like this, you know, hero thing that, you know, he took care of the kids while I couldn't, you know, and I talked about, you know, my sort of accomplishments, you know, with being a business owner and, you know, my, you know, friendships and sort of superficial things. That I felt like I, you know, hid what was going on. But during that time also, my best friend, who was concerned about the depression and kind of concerned that my husband was a large part of the depression, that it wasn't actually the steroids, that it was this culmination of years of being beaten down and criticized and berated and made to pay for everything in the household. She actually, you know, sent me an email that I had sent to her. And I sent it like 9 years prior. Furthest thing from my mind. I hadn't even remembered I sent it. And in it, I casually mentioned that, you know, my husband had been, you know, demeaning me and criticizing me, bullying me is what it was. It's not criticism. It was bullying me. And I just had simply said, I think my youngest child was maybe still, you know, maybe 9-12 months old. And I said, you know, I'm done. You know, I don't want to live, you know, with you, you know, treating me like this, especially in front of our children. And at that time, I casually mentioned an email. He said, his response was, if you try and mess with my life, I'll put a bullet through your head. And of course, explaining to my girlfriend in the email, I don't think he meant that. I think he was just frustrated and said that. Of course, she kept that email. And I said, at the end, I said that, but then at the end I said, well, you know, just kind of keep this in case something does happen to me. So it was this, you know, belief and disbelief You know, who is he? Who are we? And, here I was excusing him at the therapist's office of the wonderful guy, my rock. But I just sort of threw that in. That your friend had sent this email.
And your therapist's eyes were like,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, when I got it, my eyes were like that, too. I was like, I don't even remember. I remembered after she sent it the exactly where I was, exactly how it was said. But I hadn't in that was in that little compartment that was walled off. And, but she had recognized these patterns and she recognized it was escalating. And it was the most loving wake up call I've ever had. So yeah, so my therapist was like, this is serious.
Well, it reminds me of something that Keisha said in the film. She said, if he says it, it means he's been thinking about it. And if he's thinking about it, it means he could do it. And I think that's really hard for people to believe that somebody that they love is truly thinking about killing them.
Right, because it's not something that you expect. And here is this guy who's like very connected in the community. He had friends that he had played Little League with. I mean, you know, we had, you know, couples friends. So it was, again, that disconnect, like that's who he is, but this is who he is to me. So is it me? Is it him? Up until that point at the therapist, I'd leak little teeny things. I'd kind of throw something out there. And then I'd withdraw it because that, you know, wasn't really that man. That was still my husband who I loved. And, he was the father of my children, you know, and he had these friendships. So he must not be the kind of guy who could really kill me. And I was just so desperately trying to reconcile in my mind, of course he wouldn't do this. Why would he do this? He's just spouting off. But then my therapist called me on it. She called me on it. And you know, what did I do? I stopped seeing her. I was like, okay, this is getting like really uncomfortable. I'm feeling like I'm going to have to work here. I'm going to have to do some work. I don't want to do work. I don't want my life to change. Right. I just want to go back to what it was. Of course, it was a chaotic mess, but I didn't know what was ahead. And it's easier to hold on to something that you are familiar with, no matter how miserable you are, than it is to say, I'm going to make this change.
Well, the fear of the unknown is very powerful for many people, for most of us.
Right. And I was always kind of took on challenges like, oh, let's do this or let's do that. But, you know, this was pretty life altering. And I also knew it's not like he was going to drop off the face of the planet and my children and I would, you know, live happily ever after. He was going to have to parent them alone. And I wasn't going to be there to mitigate that. And, he did have substance use. He was an alcoholic, very highly functional, highly functional. We usually didn't have a drink till 5, but once it started and it went and it kept going. And then in the morning he'd get up, he was at work every morning. He was an early riser, 5 o'clock in the morning, he was at work. He was working, very good, dependable employee. So, I knew that about him, but I also knew that he could keep it together, but I think he was unraveling as well at the same time. So my thought was, okay, I mentioned that I had gone on some antidepressants. So the person who was prescribing them also did therapy, which is very unusual. It was an actual psychiatrist, Dr. Brown. And I said, well, maybe you can talk to my husband. Maybe we can do therapy and we can do couples therapy and you can talk some sense into him because you're a guy. Yeah, you're a guy. He's a guy. Like maybe you guys, you know, and Dr. Brown immediately shut that down. And he said, yeah, no, I don't do couples therapy. I'm going to admit I'm biased towards one person or another. And right now you're my patient and I'm biased towards you. And then he proceeded to bombard me with challenges to my thinking and to my excuses and to my examples of the interactions I was having in my marriage with healthy interactions. He never said, "You're being abused." He never used words that made me feel like, uh-oh. He just kept giving me these examples of this is how it works in loving relationships. Then he didn't say loving relationships. He's like, this is kind of how it's supposed to work. And I knew that because my parents had been married like 47 years. I mean, they argued, don't get me wrong. I mean, they weren't like perfect, but they're respectful of one another. There was never any name calling, any threats, you know, and there was an undercurrent of love. You could feel their bond. So it wasn't like it was totally unfamiliar. It was just refamiliarizing me with it. And we had a couple friends and I would look at them and I'm like, what is different? You know, why is their relationship different? And of course you're not inside. So, you know, it became clear. It became clear that not only was the relationship deteriorating, but also the abuse was escalating. And I couldn't deny, I couldn't deny his emotional, his financial, psychological abuse was a danger, not only to just me, but his children as well.
Could you, you weren't a victim of physical abuse. He didn't punch you. He didn't hit you. But he was clearly abusive, and sometimes people don't recognize that abuse because it's not black eyes and broken bones, right? So what, can you give us some examples of some of the things that he was doing that were abusive and finally in retrospect, you know, became clear to you as abuse?
You know, and here's the thing, when you tell someone some of the things that happen, they're like, it doesn't strike them as abusive. So when, you know, my 50th birthday, my girlfriend and I were planning on going away. And, you know, he was, of course, he's the dad. You would expect him to watch the children. And at the very last minute, I was literally walking out the door to drive to meet her. We were meeting in the middle. I can't even remember where we were meeting, maybe Winchester or something. But, you know, it was a good 4 or 5 hours for each of us. And he said, "I'm not watching the kids." You know, so it's that manipulation, like, okay, well, wait, you said you were watching the kids. I've had this trip planned. You know, now what am I going to do? And I had to cancel the trip. So people go, well, you know, but there was nothing other than control in that. And then it happened multiple times. I'd get on the phone. He would not let me talk to anyone in my family, my girlfriends, without in the background continually trying to get my attention. It was like having a 2-year-old, only the attention getting was bullying. It was, you know, oh, she's no good for you. You know, she always stabs you in the back. Why do you even give her the time of day? You know, she's just gonna end up, you know, screwing with your head, and, you know, kind of a lot of projection, at the time. So, and
those are isolating behaviors.
Very isolating. But
didn't work for you.
What's that?
They didn't work for you.
No, because I would just you know, go out and meet people, you know, and the last trip that I had planned, which is actually a month after I was shot, but we had planned it obviously in the summer, which our belated 50th birthday, I was a travel agent. And so, my girlfriend and I, who the one sent me the email and who I'd known since, middle school, we were going to Antigua. And he was bound and determined for that not to happen. And I knew that he wasn't dependable. So I actually had childcare lined up. He's like, well, you better take care, get somebody for the pets. And I was like, pet care lined up. Cause I knew that in order to do that, but then, you know, we had planned that months in advance, and then it became very obvious I needed to just divorce him. And so then it sort of turned into a happy separation trip as well as a 50th birthday trip. I chose, I had to make a choice. It became it got to the point where I either had to save my kids from the relationship and the example we were providing them as a couple. And with that email and that background, I knew that I was going to be navigating a minefield. And I remember emailing my therapist the night before I was going to tell my husband. And I said, this is a tipping point, and there's not going to be any turning back after this. And the healthier I got and the more I took my power back, the sicker he got. I mean, it escalated. He began stalking me, following me, you know, showing up in places. I told him, we're just going to go out for drinks, and I didn't tell him where. And then he would be there just staring at me. He'd read my mail. He'd read my email. He's dropped on conversations with friends, which he kind of done all along anyway. But he would reach out to them. At this point, he was reaching out to them, reaching out to my family, saying, oh, she's bipolar. And she even called my psychiatrist and said, you know, how's the treatment for bipolar going? And he told me, and I said, wait, am I bipolar? I was depressed. And he's like, well, no, I don't think you are. And then I started laughing. I was like, oh, right. He's setting it up so that when he goes to court to get custody of the kids, he's going to portray me as an unfit mother. He accused me of cheating, of sleeping with my psychiatrist, of sleeping with my girlfriend. I'm not a lesbian, but, you know, she got in there because we were friendly, running up my credit cards, frivolously spending money. My credit cards were actually maxed because I paid for everything for the children. You know, I mean, anything. They needed a pair of shoes. They needed, registration for Girl Scouts. They needed, you know, soccer shoes. That was my job because I wanted those children. He insisted that he was going to use my therapy visits to prove that I was an unfit mother, and that he would get full custody of the children, and that I would never see them again. And even with all of that, I said, I've got to get out, and I've got to figure out how to get them once I do.
Right.
But I got to put my oxygen mask on, and I got to figure out. And I knew, as much as I loved them, that I might be leaving them with him. And that was the hardest decision. I mean, I just can't even tell you. But I knew that if I wasn't going to survive, they were going to end up with him anyway.
Right.
And I also knew that he just didn't have the fortitude to, you know, truly be a full-time father. I mean, he would do it for a while, but he would have just, you know, it was a manipulation, and I knew that. So.
Wow. So you had these threats, you had this intimidation, but you told him you were leaving. What would you do differently if you had to do it over again?
What I would do the same is I stayed the course to exit the marriage. All these things he put in the way, I just kept going. I was actually trying to get the retainer together for my attorney. In retrospect, I would have totally borrowed that money. It's like, he said it's probably going to be, he said something interesting. He said, I've dealt with guys like this and he's going to go for scorched earth. And then he attached a price tag on that. And the scorched earth that he was talking about was like financial, but as it turned out, it was more than financial. He was going for scorched earth. Nothing was going to be left standing. Right. So I would borrow the money for the retainer, because I certainly had friends who would have loaned it to me, but I didn't even see a way to sort of pay it back because I did have some credit card debt. My attorney actually also, as things were escalating the final week, I had reached out to him and he said, look, you know, if something happens this weekend, you need to call 911 and then call me. And it's because there hadn't been overt physical. I mean, he had pulled my hair, pinched me, blocked my way out of a room, which is absolutely physical. But you don't, you know, we're all Hollywooded. We're all, you got to have a black eye or he's going to knock your teeth out. That is absolutely physical abuse. I mean, he would shove me against the wall, but he didn't hit me, and so.
There was also a sexual assault in there, right?
Right. You know, and that was, it was, it, the, And I work with sexual assault survivors now and domestic violence survivors now. So it was, you know, we were always taught what rape is, you know, somebody's tearing off your clothes and someone's, you know, forcing themselves on you. And
it's a stranger.
And it's a stranger. And so we have this, you know, even at that time, I knew that it was like totally warped. But I didn't call it a sexual assault I wasn't even really honest with my psychiatrist. Even after all that time and that rapport we had, I couldn't bring myself to say my own husband sexually assaulted me. So I sort of sugarcoated it, I guess, if you will. Yes, but he did. And that is what prompted me that final day to the Friday before that weekend, he shot me, to call my lawyer and say, I got to, you know, and he must have had some inkling that something was really ramped up. And my psychiatrist did. They did not, neither of them, say, hey, you know, you might want to call a domestic violence agency. Maybe this is the time. So in your question, and what would I do different? Had I known the resources, I had called the local domestic violence agency when the first threat came out. You know, I'll put a bullet through your head if you try and mess with my life. And they were sort of like, well, you know, we have this, you know, this shelter and there's other families there. And I said, can my kids go to the same school? Well, no, not really. Well, a lot had happened in the 10 years between, or 9 years between, when I had reached out then and when I was actually shot. A lot had happened, but I wasn't aware of that. And I also didn't see myself as this victim. I mean, here I was, you know, I was this, you know, really, you know, self-assured, you know, sort of get the world by the tail. You know, I didn't see myself as a victim. And I thought, well, that's for people who, you know, have been beaten up. And so I didn't call them the second go around. Had my attorney, any of the doctors I saw during that time period, my therapist, my psychiatrist, had they said, or even friends said, hey, you know, maybe you want to reach out with them. Maybe they can do some safety planning with you. And, you know, and so I would have understood, look, this is no turning back. And he had met with a mutual friend that week also. And he had told the mutual friend, I can't live without her. But nobody saw that as a red flag. Nobody said, wait, you know, all this stuff that's going on, this sounds very dangerous. And so police were never called to my house. They were never, you know, what was I going to tell them? Like he's calling me, you know, he's calling me names. Like he threw the plate across the room because he didn't like what dinner tasted like tonight, or, you know, well, like, what do you call and tell them? And so, you know, we're sort of all using this litmus of physical violence or danger. And as you and I know now, that is absolutely out the door.
Well, you know, what I have, I've seen studies showing up to 35% of homicide victims had no previous history of abuse. Physical abuse. All right. Were in very controlling relationships.
Right.
And I also read a study that only 4% of homicide victims ever reach out to a domestic violence organization.
And we need to change that. We need to change that. But you know, then the issue with the police is when something does happen, and, you know, they're looking for, it's a crime scene, they're looking for evidence of violence when they arrive. And they don't see a pattern that a survivor is sharing with them. Well, he did this and he did that. And sometimes she's also in the moment too. So she's, you know, traumatized, screaming, and he's sitting on the chair going, yeah, you know, look at that. You know, this is what I have to deal with. And that my husband is exactly like that. He's like, oh, go ahead and call the police. You're not going to do anything.
Yeah, who's going to look like the crazy person here?
Right.
And that's usually the case. I mean, you know, domestic violence victims are, by the time they picked up the phone and called the police, they are hysterical.
Right, right.
For good reason. They're afraid.
pushed and prodded and poked and like emotionally, and it's just like it, to your breaking point. And, you know, I didn't want to admit to myself, I'm, you know, the smart, the successful person, you know, I can tackle anything. I can handle this too. And I, it was hard to, it's not hard for me to reach out for help at all. Never. But it was hard for me to have that moment of truth with myself, as it doesn't matter what you call yourself, this is what you're experiencing. And I think we use labels, you know, way too often. If what you're experiencing is unhealthy, it doesn't matter whether you label it, you know, yourself a victim or a survivor, or, you know, you label it domestic violence or whatever. What counts is getting, reaching out and getting the right resources. And so, you know, again, the resources are huge, and people don't understand, you know, I also was afraid somebody was going to make me do something, and nobody wants to be made to do something. I wanted to have sort of autonomy on what was going to happen next. Of course, he was not giving me any autonomy on what was going to happen next. Yeah. He had set his path, and he knew exactly what he was going to do. He knew it earlier in the summer. I had walked on him putting bullets in a gun, and I thought he was going to shoot himself. But then, and I literally closed the door behind me. It was at night. It was pitch black. And I don't know how I did this. It was just adrenaline. I closed the door behind me. I was like, your son's on the other side of that wall. How could you do this to him? Thinking he's going to take his own life. And then after I exited, I was like, wait a minute. You know, was he going to take us all out? And then like 45 minutes later, he came in and he said, you just didn't understand what you saw. Like, I was, you know, storing the gun. And I was like, well, why would you store the gun with bullets in it? Most people. And he said, well, you know, I've been traveling with it. I was like, why are you traveling with a gun? I've been traveling with it. And he's, I've got it, you know, in my dresser drawer. And I said, well, you've got a 9-year-old son. I hardly think that's a secure place for it. You know, he's, oh, he understands gun. He would never take out the gun. And I'm thinking, he's 9 years old. It's a gun. He's curious. That's how kids get shot every single day, being curious, even though they know. I mean, you tell your kids, don't jump down that flight of steps. And what's the first thing they do?
Jump down the flight of steps.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not enough to tell kids. You have to secure. So I'd already had that. And again, that went in that box. Right. Okay. But I knew that things were escalating. I was just trying to walk this tightrope of like, okay, I don't want to upset him. I don't want anything to be so quick, where I really, in hindsight, should have gathered the kit, gotten the money for the attorney, gathered the kids and gotten out and figured out where they're going to go to school and, you know, what's going to happen next. But he's still in the court system, you know, the custody. There was nothing that showed he was an unfit father. So we would have been sharing custody. I was trying to mitigate that too. As Kate says in the movie, it's like you're trying to reel in this tornado. You're trying to grab hold of something that's just so out of control. Yeah.
And, you know, so many of the women, you know, your survivor sisters, right? You're all really strong women, and none of you wants to be thought of as a victim. Nobody wants to think of themselves as a victim. You know, you think of yourself as a strong person, but there's that whole victimology piece of it that puts you in a place of, well, what's wrong with me? How come? And it's a personal failure. Women by nature are, or by design of our society, are the keepers of the relationships. Mm-hmm. And when those relationships fail, we kind of take it personally, and try to figure out what we did wrong, that we couldn't keep it together, not really looking at relationships as a partnership. You know, some of that we bring with us, because it's kind of what we've been taught. And we kind of look at, you know, I think part of the reason men get away with abuse is because we kind of look at them as not really all that great at relationships. You know, you kind of like they get a pass because they're not good at it, like we are, you know.
Exactly. And but some men are good at it. And so, yeah, they get a pass.
It's a learned behavior.
Right. Right. They get and societally, they get a lot of passes from other people. Oh, you know, and people always say, oh, well, you know, what happened to him in his childhood that made him like that? I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know that answer, but I do know this. He made a conscious choice. There was no remote control on him that said, oh, I've had this horrible childhood, so it's okay for me to do this to my family. You know, it is, and even his family, you know, were very enabling of his behavior after everything had happened. It was all out. But you know, they felt like I had done something that made him do that, as though I had a remote control on him, that you know, he was driven to the edge by me. And I tried to reassure myself, people get divorced every day. You know, that, as I said, you know, they're not always the most pleasant of circumstances. You know, people don't just always just grow apart. You know, sometimes it can be contentious, but it isn't always abusive, and it isn't always, and it's like alcoholism. There's tons of alcoholics that would not hurt anyone. Right. And there are tons of abusive people who aren't alcoholics or drug users. So they're just so kind of co-occurring, but not necessarily, you know,
causal
related.
Right. So we you and I could talk for hours, and we've been known to do so in the past. But I want to kind of wrap up by talking just briefly about your work right now, because you're working with as an advocate for victims of abuse. How's that going? How does your work?
It's hard to say that as much as everything has changed, not much has changed. So I see my role, the successes are, you know, measurable. I see my role as, I am very honest to say, I'm not a therapist. So I'm not your there, dear girl. Okay. A therapist is there for that. I'm here. And I'm, you know, do you want me to sugarcoat it, or do you want me to shoot it straight? And 100% of and I work predominantly with women that I speak to, say, tell it to me straight. Don't sugarcoat it. And I'm like, this is who he is. Because she's thinking there's something wrong with me. I've got to fix this relationship. I've got to fix me. I've got to fix this. And I'm like, this is who he is. Right. Same tree, apples from the same tree. And so I think it's very validating for them to hear, wait, that sounds just like him. These are the tactics he uses, and other people use them too. And, you know, and then they get to a point the same as I did. Once you know something, you can't unknow it. So many times the survivors I work with choose to go back into the relationship, and that's their journey. I don't share my story with them. I mean, sometimes, you know, as it goes, people will Google me and look me up, and it's pretty easy to find me. But I don't, it's not my journey. It's not about me at that point. But I can impart some wisdom of what I know, as you know, as we talked about, sort of my obsessive research into sort of the driving behaviors. And if we understand the driving behaviors of abusers, we can also be preemptive. And so I use that as a part of safety planning, because, you know, after this big blow up, he's probably going to say, I'm sorry, you know, I didn't, you know, please just drop the case with the police. You know, I'm not like that. I just lost, you know, I was just drinking. I just lost, you know, whatever excuse they have. And I tell them, this is going to happen. And when you do not respond, he's going to blow up. Just wait. And so once they see the patterns, I feel like they are empowered to make the choices, and I'm just there as the framework to support them.
I think that it's really important because, again, it comes back to talking to somebody that's fundamentally a strong person, and not disempowering them, not taking their control away, because that's what the abusive relationship is doing. You don't want to be repeating that experience for them.
Right. And I applaud them. And I will tell them, you've done a great job keeping you and your kids safe to this point. Because whatever, you know, it looks like, you guys are still here. So, and I don't sugarcoat it. I say, this is the hardest thing you are ever going to do. It gets so much harder before it gets easier, but it does get easier. And you know, you have to be in that place where you feel like you don't want to be treated like this anymore, and you don't deserve to be treated like this. And then, you know, they don't. No one deserves to be. No one, no matter what has happened in their life, whatever they've done, you know, or not done. And I think the introspection of survivors is, well, maybe I caused this. And you know, I'm clear to say, no, you didn't cause it, and you can't cure it. You cannot love it out of them. Yeah. So you may love them, but the healthiest thing for you, and you know, if they have children, but even singles, you have to choose what you want your life to be like. And it's, you know, I have some really difficult days. Even this is 11 years later, I still have some days where it's really extraordinarily difficult to get out of bed. I hear that chatter in the back of my head, that nin, 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 that nitpicking relentlessness 11 years later. Of course, we were together almost 30 years, all said and done. But I still hear that, and I have to quiet that voice and get up and do the next thing. But, there, you know, and I thank you for saying I'm strong. I don't know that I use that term myself. I think I'm tenacious. And I loved that Perseverance landed on Mars. It took them 8 years to make that happen. And that was sort of my victory. Like, if they got Perseverance on Mars, like, I can do this too. And I try and encourage clients, like, you can do this. You can do this. I have every confidence. It's just hard. It's hard.
And it's also dangerous, as your story points mm-hmm. out. And so one of the things that we're going to do with this video in podcasts is we will include links to the National Hotline and the National Network to End Domestic Violence, where you can see information on safety planning. Don't do it by yourself. Get help. Talk to friends, talk to people who have been there, talk to advocates, talk to your local domestic violence shelter. Because as you know, Lisette's experience bears out, it can be extremely dangerous to just leave. Even though everybody says, why doesn't she just leave? It's not safe.
And people do leave, and that you don't, abusers don't magically disappear. They are still there. And especially if you share children with them. So the safety planning is both in preparation to leave, as well as what will happen after someone leaves. And, you know, any intervention at any point of abuse is, I believe, has a greater chance of a positive outcome.
Well, thank you so much for being a part of this podcast. Thank you so much for being a part of Finding Jen's Voice. And thank you for being my friend. I am happy to be doing this Voices for Change radio show. And I'm so appreciative to Hope Gibbs for her facilitation. Thank you. And we'll see you next time.
On Voices for Change, you can stream Finding Jen's Voice, an amazing movie by Tracy Schott with Lisette and other survivors, which is really remarkable. Lisette, I just have to say my heart hurts after hearing your story. It's just so breathtaking. And we're so glad you're here and that you are a voice for other women, that strength, that rock. I think that strength is really the word of the day for you. And I want to end on a positive note, because at Incandescent, we try and, you know, as horrible as things are, we always feel there's a shining light, a silver circle around us. So I will reflect back on what Mars Rover sent back in a tweet. It said, perseverance will get you everywhere. So here's to that, right? So surviving change, surviving everything, right? Shamelesssurvivors.com is Lisette's website. Voices for Change is Tracy's. And you can listen to all of this on Facebook and also at Incandescent Radio and on Incandescent TV. So we will be back with you with another episode next Tuesday, and we will continue talking with Lisette. Just amazing. So everybody stay safe. Words of wisdom from both of these amazing women. We'll talk to you soon. Mm-hmm.